I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for brevity, and we hope you like it.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2015, the Vermont State Legislature passed Act 46, a school district consolidation law. It had several phases where schools and communities were given incentives to voluntarily merge districts over the next couple of years. Many districts did just that, even when it took a lot of effort and some unhappiness from families and teachers in those districts. In fact, about 157 districts did come together to form 39 new unified districts. But the last phase of the law allows the state to essentially force mergers in some communities that haven't already done it on their own. The first step in those forced mergers has just happened. In June, the Vermont Agency of Education, under the interim leadership of Heather Bushy, released a statewide merger plan to evaluate plans for the remaining 44 districts. It found that 18 districts should be making mergers. That's not going over well in all of those communities. Now, a new leader has to step in to figure out how to make things work, how to make school communities feel whole, and how to balance the delicate politics between the governor and lawmakers on education issues. Dan French took over as education secretary last week, and he joins us today. Welcome back to the show in this new role.
Thank you, Jane.
Why did you want this job?
Oh, wow. I guess out of a sense of responsibility. You might know I'm a long-serving educator in the state of Vermont and been involved in systems change at the local level. And I'm really concerned, like many Vermonters, about the future of our public education system and see it as a vital element of our economic and social success. So I, you know, offered my leadership as secretary, and the governor was kind enough to appoint me to the job.
Your predecessor, Rebecca Holcomb, stepped down, resigned, and by all accounts, it sounds like because she didn't like the policies of the governor. You know, you serve at the pleasure of the governor. Do you like his policies? Do you think his ideas for education, his five-year plan, is the right one?
Yeah, I obviously, went through an elaborate application process for the position, and we had to check in on a number of those elements. And I think, yes, to, particularly on the idea of really looking at education not as a silo unto itself, but looking as education as a function of economic and social development, which I think the governor's vision is right on. And it's where people all around the world are coming to that same conclusion, you know, in a knowledge-based economy. Education is just critical in terms of job development and economic development and our broader social development.
But that's not specific to the plans that the governor has. But, because it does come down to those details and comes down to
right.
The funding and comes down to the mergers and all of those things where if you don't see eye to eye, this is going to be a problematic job and a problematic scene for the governor, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're basically asking me to comment on the end of the legislative session last year. And
I have a specific question for you about that. I mean, yes, but also
sure.
Philosophically. So let's do philosophy first, and then let's talk about, you know, actual policy and politics.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a great way to go. So, in terms of a general sort of philosophical approach, I think, 100%. I think where there's, you know, it's a complex policy environment. And when you start looking at the very specific policy initiatives, which I think there will be, you know, sort of a reset in this next legislative session. And, I look forward to partnering with the different policy stakeholders on these issues. But they're very complex. But the overarching ones, which I think are fairly well expressed in the policy goals of Act 46, you know, that we're on this point now where we really have to think about designing an education system. And I'm not really sure, based on my experience, whether the current structure I could qualify as a system. Historically, it's sort of just been a hodgepodge, you know, of elements cobbled together. And sometimes it works very effectively. But we have so many societal and economic challenges in terms of, in our communities. And it really requires education to be more systematic. And I think so. Yeah, the devil's going to be in the details for sure. But my job is to, you know, right now to sort of assess the larger, sort of seek a message of coherence. And I think certainly Act 46 is front and center on that. But as we get into the specific policy debate, I think, you know, where I specifically was quite excited about the governor's vision is I think it comes down to is this addressing these challenges? Is it going to happen on an incremental basis, or are we about evolving the system to a different place? And my leadership as a superintendent has always been about that future sort of evolving sort of leadership. So I'm in agreement in that regard that we need to really think a little more dramatically about change, and that the incremental change isn't going to be sufficient or timely enough to address our situation.
Think you can get lawmakers on board with that? Not to say that lawmakers don't agree with that philosophy, but when it comes down to passing laws, that's right. been a difficult space for lawmakers and the governor.
Yeah, and I've had some experience when I was president of the Superintendent Association working with lawmakers on some of these policy issues, particularly the governance ones. I was very involved in those. So I know it can be challenging. And I think, you know, come back to Act 46 and its policy goals, there was some really strong bipartisan agreement about those policy objectives. You know, yes, I think, you know, we'll be certainly everyone's wondering now at this point where we're looking at the state essentially imposing, you know, consolidation on districts. When we get to that kind of point, there's going to have to be a check-in on, you know, what is the role of the state? What is the role of the locals in terms of structuring our education system? But I think, you know, at that higher level, hopefully there's agreement and consensus that we have to we need a more thoughtful approach to education policy and a more integrated approach to education policy if we're going to be successful as a state.
Has Act 46 and school district consolidation been a success in your eyes?
Yes. I think like many folks, when the law first came out, it's a challenging policy to make sense of. And I was somewhat surprised that a large number of districts found their way forward under the accelerated aspect, which was really that first year of the law. But I've done some work as consultant around the state with different situations and complex governance systems, and I'm continually to be impressed at how folks have found a path forward locally to do that. And I think, you know, once again, the policy goals have really brought people together around how they could not only improve quality, equity, but also the efficiency of their system. So I think it's been a success, yes.
These remaining a little more than 40 districts that didn't voluntarily merge and now are in this process, they've had to submit a plan to the state saying either, you know, here's how we're going to abide by the rules set out in Act 46, or here's how we think we can merge. And in many cases said, we don't want to merge. We don't think we can merge. Right. We don't think this is good for our town. And the state has come back in 18 of those communities and said, here's the mergers we think should work. Now, that's not set in stone. Right. We have until the end of November for sort of negotiations between the state and these communities before anything is really locked in. But, you know, my understanding from people I've talked to in some of the towns, especially in the Northeast Kingdom, is they're not happy about this and they feel like this is Montpelier dictating sure. to them something that doesn't work in small rural communities and not listening to them when they say this doesn't work. Now, you worked in Canaan for a long time, you know, way up north, right next to the New Hampshire right. border. So you have experience working in small rural communities right. that feel that distance yep. to the state house. So what do you now step in and say to them about yeah. where they are in this process?
Well, I had last night, actually, I wasn't in Canaan, but I was in the other corner of the state. I was invited to come up and speak to folks in Franklin and Highgate. And they certainly were not shy about sharing their opinions. And, you know, really, you know, it's a great sort of case of, you know, the effects of this law and how folks are really struggling with the pros and cons of doing it. So hopefully, you know, first thing is to educate, you know, those districts as to what is specifically the moment in time they're in and what are their options, you know, under the law. And, you know, we have some obligation at the agency, you know, to put out the draft articles, for instance. Hopefully those will be out today. They were more or less ready last week, but I was still new on the job and I wanted to review them a little bit. So hopefully we'll get those out to folks. That's an important element. But I think the legislature was prudent in turning this phase of the process over to a deliberative body such as the State Board of Education. So it is more of a political process at the end, and the districts have had ample opportunity and still ongoing to influence that. And the State Board, I only attended one meeting so far. We have one more to go, which is they're in this mode of basically taking testimony from the different groups that are affected in different communities. And I think, you know, I could already start to see the deliberations of the State Board trying to say, okay, we're almost done with this sort of phase of the process. Now we want to turn to really evaluating the Secretary's proposal, which was sort of a starting point on their deliberations. But now they need to factor in the political aspects of that. Where I tried to go with them at the end of the meeting, and I think, you know, I'm a non-voting member of the board as a secretary. I'd encourage them to go back and really look at those policy elements of the law. You know, the legislature, I think, did a really good job of saying, you know, the goal here is to create more sustainable structures so that locals can do these five things those are really the sole criteria the board should have. And well, I should say one of the primary criteria they should have when they're evaluating at the end of the day to what extent the either the alternative structure or the preferred structure is implemented in these communities.
We should say Canaan is among the communities that can't merge because of the way that the
There's no easy way to merge Canaan. I mean, they're just, you know, they're out there and
And for legal considerations, too, I understand that sometimes the structure
The structures have to line up, and the state has limited authority around that. So,
let's go to Jody, who's calling in from Dummerston. Hi, Jody. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Welcome to this Act 46 process, Secretary French.
Thank you.
Good luck. I'd like to know if you believe that alternative governance structures are allowed under the law and that public votes should be honored, or if you would consider them merely public sentiment. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your call. That's an issue I've heard quite a bit on. And I would say just a little bit of introduction. I'm not totally new to Act 46, so I've been down in the trenches on it for a while and in some cases involved in the formation of the approach. So I think it's you raised some good points that have certainly been echoed by other communities. I think, you know, my impression, the secretary's requirement produced the draft plan. You know, the parameters by which the secretary could navigate that are really limited by what the law describes. I think the state board has inherently more flexibility to consider things like local sentiment. But, you know, as someone who's pretty fluent as both a consultant, as a superintendent in the parameters of Act 46, when I hear folks have voted on these things, I wonder what they voted on, you know, just clinically interested in that. So I saw a headline this morning. I forget what political blog it was, and it was something to the effect, community votes overwhelmingly against merger, you know. But then I unpacked that to look at what the question was they voted on, you know, what specifically the question was. And the question was actually, shall the community advise the school board to close its school in order to prevent merger?
So it wasn't even a merger question.
Yeah, so the devil's in the details on some of these things. But I think, you know, the state board, what I've seen is, to the answer to the caller's question more directly, is very interested in considering, you know, what the local sentiment is to that. If I were to make some general statements having seen how this is rolled out in different communities, I would say my impression, folks have difficulty working through something as complex as Act 46 if they haven't had experience working as a system before. So places that have been running fairly, you know, independently of each other or not as a single supervisory unit as a system, you throw something like Act 46 in front of them, it's very, very challenging for them to do. So,
also challenging for voters because if you're not steeped in this and if perhaps you haven't, you know, you get a question on your town meeting ballot and it's like, well, I don't know how to vote on this. I don't know what the implications are. And it, certainly for many voters, there's a fear that what really is going to happen is a closure of their local school. And we got a question from that in Brownsville from Elizabeth, and I'll read it to you and then I'll let you respond. Yeah. She says, can you be specific about the financial and social benefits of school consolidation to small towns in our state? I'm not asking about administrative or operations. Please be specific when you tell us why a small town with no school would be attractive to the young families we are supposed to be drawing to our state and how these towns will thrive instead of wither. So Elizabeth, going right to school closure here, which, you know, is not what Act 46 talks about, but could be the natural implication of many mergers.
Yeah, and the logic, it's a good, you know, I'm glad you teased out the logic of that because the two shouldn't be conflated necessarily. And actually, if you just clinically were to read the merger articles that have been approved by most communities, they've taken advantage of merger to protect exactly that, you know, to include additional protections to ensure that the community in which the school is located controls the ultimate destiny of that school. But the issue of small schools is one I know quite well. I was, as a superintendent when I was in Canaan, involved in closing the Norton School when it got down to 6 students. And that was a 50% drop in enrollment from when it was at 14 students, K-8. So, you know, folks, when I go down to Manchester and talk about that, they'd be like, oh, that's outrageous or whatever. And I'm like, you need to understand the geography of Norton, right? These are still very, very difficult and emotional decisions. But rightfully so, these are decisions that are left in the hands of the local communities, not the state. So Act 46 doesn't give the state authority to close schools. In many cases, as I mentioned, districts can take advantage of the merger to instill different additional protections to ensure that small schools aren't closed arbitrarily. But I think small schools in particular at the elementary level are going to be a really important element of how we meet the needs of students in our communities. And particularly around literacy education, students need to have an educational home that's accessible, if you will. And I think, you know, we need to ensure that those small schools are viable in the future.
But if what we're ultimately looking for is cost containment and
yes.
cost savings, and we're seeing we're continuing to see declining enrollment, student enrollment as the school age population drops, won't or will schools need to close in order to reach those savings and to be able to actually teach children the way they need to be taught? I mean, a school with 6 or 8 children could be a wonderful school, but it also could be a school where kids don't have a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, just to use the Norton example again, you know, a K-8 school with 14 students, right? But, you know, what were the other options? The geography just really necessitated that. But we worked really hard to bring those students down into Canaan. You know, it was a 30-minute ride on a good day. And in the winter, there weren't many good days. But students, you know, were able to access art and some of the integrated arts work in Canaan as opposed to in their small school. But I think, you know, it will be a rub. And I think in particular, I would draw the distinction between small elementary schools and small high schools. I think for me, I feel more urgency on the issue of small high schools and particularly what they can or cannot offer. When I was principal, I had 150 students, grades 7 through 12. And we really worked hard, and I thought we did a good job in terms of offering students options, but we worked really hard to get those students out into the rest of the world so they could be successful in whatever they wanted to do. But increasingly, those schools have gotten smaller and smaller. And I've worked with districts, that have 50 students in 9 through 12 or 150 students 7 through 12, and it's really hard to offer what students need today in that environment, particularly if there's a viable option that's accessible down the road. And I'm not talking about, 2 hours on a bus, but if there's 10 minutes away a viable option, then we really have to think about that. And those are hard decisions, and I know communities are on those right now.
Yeah, and for people who think that Act 46 really is a sneaky way to get to schools closing
right.
and school consolidation, you know, Even hearing that it's going to be a deliberate process and it's going to be done with students and communities in mind is probably not going to allay their fears.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to, assuage that. I mean, in my experience, I could say I'm thinking of Sunderland Elementary School where my wife still works. You know, at one point they were down to 37 students. That school wouldn't exist today, and it buoyed up to about 80 students. That school probably wouldn't exist today if they weren't brought in as part of a system. You know, we were able to bring bandwidth into that building. We were able to bring a more robust curriculum. We were able to improve the physical plant. We were able to lower their tax rate. All those things were because we started to think more systemically about how to integrate that small school into a larger system. So, you know, it can cut both ways.
Bob is calling in from Barton. Hi, Bob. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. My point is that when it comes to school funding, we need to display a lot of caution in making any cuts, because in our culture, in our society, there is not a level playing field, and the schools are the one institution that attempts to make that level playing field as much a reality as possible. I know that I have been the beneficiary of white privilege my whole life, and we need to account for efforts like this in our school systems.
Bob, I appreciate that statement, and I'll turn it over to Dan French to talk about how do we address that, and also to pair it with the question of how do we improve test scores specifically for low-income students. We have not made much progress over the years in closing that gap between higher-income students and lower-income students, and to the extent that school is the answer, how do we do that, and how do we get to Bob's question about making sure there's equity and equality?
Yeah, I think it's a great question or observation, and to me, it just points back to it resonates with me and my experience that we need to do that through building coherent systems.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what that means, for instance, on the school level is that school districts work together. You know, K through 12, not just in isolation. So in not to point back to governance change, but in many cases, elementary schools working in systems that haven't been consolidated, working in isolation, and then wondering why, the feeding into a common high school, for instance, that students start off in high school at different places. That's, we've gotten by with that kind of in the past a little bit, but the increase, the international context in which our students are being educated today, that's no longer acceptable. So, systematic at the local level means we need to have a well-articulated curriculum. It means school boards really need to be incrementally monitoring for student outcomes. So we, you know, we're a local control state. We rely as a system, when we talk about system outcomes for students, we rely a lot on school boards doing their end of it. So we really need to make sure those governance elements are working well. And I think so school boards engaging their communities about what are those values and what do they want to see for outcomes for students, and then putting those values into policy and using boards using their policy tool to really drive the direction of the district. And with that, also how do boards evaluate their superintendents, you know, to make sure that superintendent evaluation is well articulated and also includes student outcomes as an essential element of the evaluation. So there's some things I think we can do around local control in terms of what, you know, what is local control, but really local governance, to making sure that governance is done in a way that advances the equity issues and the quality issues on an incremental level. So when it comes time to do the state reporting, we can say, you know, we have consensus in the field on how to do this. And I think those kinds of things I pointed at are based on my experience both as a superintendent and as a consultant. But what we really need to do, there's some really – the boards that are really doing good jobs at this in other places where it's not so good or uneven. And this is kind of my central observation right now based on my week and a half of being secretary, is that we have some pockets of excellence that just need to be scaled better across the state. So this is going to be the perennial theme I hope to call attention to, is that we need to be more deliberate about how we scale best practice in the state. It's not okay that, you know, we have best practices going on in these little islands of excellence, and that we really need to scale those more elaborately or be more intentional about doing that from the ground up.
When you tackle Bob's question about, you know, justice and social justice, yeah, and racial justice and socioeconomic justice, and in your answer you go to the boards, to the school boards. Right. So you think that dealing with this question of achievement gaps and test scores, that really the board plays a big role in that?
They do. I mean, to round out the rest of the question or the answer, I think they're, you know, one of the questions I was asked through the secretary search process, you know, I think it was by the state board, you know, are you a top-down or a bottom-up person? You know, and I said, well, it's kind of both, you know. So we have to design certain things from the ground up. But the state has an important role in terms of accountability, and that role is essentially to ensure quality and equity across the entire system. So, you know, this is, I think, the key point in terms of where we're heading as a system, and really being intentional about designing what is the state role, what is the local role. But I think, you know, unfortunately, with No Child Left Behind Act, so much emphasis has been put on the accountability system, which is really an emphasis on the state and the state testing system. In local control states like Vermont, we have to acknowledge that we delegate a lot of authority to local boards. And if we're going to talk about outcomes as a state, we need to make sure that local work is done well. And that's where we can, I think there's expertise. I know there's expertise out there in a number of districts that are doing excellent work. It's a question of really scaling that across.
See, you do sound like the governor here in this sense of you know, appreciating local control, but also seeing a role for the state to play in certain things, there should be statewide, not control, but that there are things that should be disseminated at the state level.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you brought me in here a couple of years ago as a consultant and said, what do you see so far and what do you think based on your experience as an ed leader? I would have said the same thing to you, because, you know, what I've been successful, I think, doing in my systems is that really finding that right balance and respecting the democratic control of that. But democratic local control doesn't mean you do whatever you want to do. You know, these are very complex systems, and the state ultimately has the responsibility. It delegates a lot of that responsibilities to locals, and we need to make sure that's being done in a way that can prepare kids for the 21st century. You know?
What about in terms of a statewide teacher's contract, statewide teacher's health care plan? I spoke with one retired teacher in Island Pond last week at a VPR event who said, don't you understand that the health care contract, the health care policy, is one of our main bargaining chips. And if you take that away, you're actually taking the power away from the teachers to do any bargaining. And we already feel like, you know, we're not making enough. We don't have a lot of power. So how do you approach that issue?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a complex issue. It's one that I think it has a lot of merit that we have to look at health insurance in particular statewide. I mean, my initial look at that when the Affordable Care Act came out was, this is way too complex of an issue to try to bargain locally. I had at one point when I was superintendent in Manchester, we were bargaining six contracts simultaneously. And we ultimately were successful in merging those six contracts together. But you take an issue like healthcare, and particularly the healthcare change that was coming out of federal policy, very complex issue. So I appreciate that perspective. and there needs to be a balance in the collective bargaining statute. But this, it comes to a point where it's just too complex of an issue, and it's too important of an issue, to just leave to all these sort of micro negotiations going on statewide. So I think it's really something we need to look at. I've been a long advocate for looking at it at state level,
specifically to healthcare. What about a statewide teachers' contract?
Yeah, I think that's a little more challenging. I think there are real disparities in teacher compensation. You talk about equity issue, we were talking a minute ago about rural schools and, their efficiency. Well, in some of the more urban areas, they compensate teachers exceedingly at higher rates. So, we can look at inefficiency or high costs also in the urban areas of Vermont. So there we need to think about that. And I think it's going to be challenging to bring, if I think specifically about salary schedules, it's going to be hard to bring salary schedules together. Perhaps we could start on a regional basis to do that. But I think it's more, back to the FTE issue or that debate. I think, it's really a question first about getting a handle on the number of staff in the buildings relative to the number of students. But I'd be interested in exploring the collective bargaining aspect. But I'm not overly optimistic that it's going to be easy to do statewide. I think there's too many disparities in the contracts.
Let's go here to Bob, who's calling in from Essex. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you, Jane. And Commissioner, congratulations and best of luck.
Thank you.
As a retired educator, it seems to me that one of your roles, and it may not be in your job description, but will be to function as a mediator between the state's education community and the governor. Unfortunately, over the last couple legislative sessions, largely because of some kind of last-minute proposals, including the whole thing around teacher-student ratio adjustment and so on, I think there's been a rift that's developed that's perhaps widening quietly. Some educators perceive that the governor would like to slap educators on the hand, and perception becomes reality, unfortunately. So I'm wondering how you feel about that mediator role. And then secondly, I would be interested on your ideas regarding teacher-student ratio reductions as a means of cost containment, as ratios alone don't tell the whole story, as you know. So
sure.
Go for it.
Yeah, thanks for the call. It is interesting. I've been getting congratulations coupled with, Yeah, first, as in the mediator issue, I think it is, it is a point of tension in that I think education has often been standing alone in state policy. And, we've had this huge change a few years ago where the governor can directly appoint the secretary. And, those of us that were advocates of that, and I was one as a superintendent, and there wasn't a strong consensus in the superintendents that this was a good idea due to the potential increased politicization of education. But my argument to that was, locally I reported the 54 school board members, you couldn't get much more political than that, But I think we're at this point now where we need to think about education more systemically. And, education can't stand alone. And that's part of my message internally to the AOE staff. We're working through that as an agency as well. And we need to have a thoughtful, integrated approach to economic and social development. And education, in a knowledge-based economy is critical to that. So we're going to have to reconcile that. And I welcome the opportunity, I wouldn't say mediator per se, but to lead that transition and to, I think, part of the solution is to articulate the future vision and to surface our values, which are, I think, universally held at all levels in the state in terms of our commitment to high quality and equity for students. The question is now, what is the structure in the future going to look like? And I'm pretty confident the values need to be protected and will be protected, but we need to work on, what the structure will be that will deliver that both efficiently and effectively for students in the future. What was the second part of the question?
Bob, I also wanted to know about ratios, specific questions.
Oh, yeah, the
ratios.
So there's been a task force established, and I'll be convening that under the statute requires that I convene that authority, and I'll be participating in that process. So we have a stakeholder group, as you can imagine, the folks that are usually involved in these kinds of things, and we'll be looking at some policy options for the legislature to consider. When we think about cost and, firstly, do we have a spending problem? And I think it's hard to deny we don't. If we look nationally, we spend spend more per pupil than most other states. And 80% of our costs in school districts are related to personnel. If all Vermont students were in one school, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But, you know, we've got to figure out a thoughtful approach to policy to deal with it. So we've got a task force in place, and hopefully we'll surface some good options for the legislature to consider.
There's a chance that you won't be in this job for
That's correct.
Than 6 months, right? I mean, if we had a new governor in November who comes into power in January, that governor could choose not to keep you on the job. So are you trying to look ahead to that potential future and sort of campaign for yourself for whoever wins?
No, I see this opportunity for me to advance the work I've done as a superintendent. You know, I care deeply about the success of our system and positioning in a way that could really implement a world-class education for all of our students. So for me, this is just a continuation of work I've done early, and my eye's on that ball. It's not really concerned about the political machinations of that.
It'd be a hard thing to take a job, though, that doesn't have any job security.
That's what superintendents do every day. You know, so I'm used to flying without a net, you know, and it's part of what we do, and that's the obligation of leadership, you know, is to try to provide that service. So I'm happy to be able to do that.
Well, we're going to have a lot more opportunities, even if it is just 6 months, but certainly in addition to that, if it's longer, to have more questions posed to you, more topics to discuss. So I appreciate you coming here to initiate that conversation today, and we look forward to talking with you again. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.